modular, interactive modular, ring, ring, ring. Trying to get this song stuck in your head.
You son of a bitch.
Yeah, I know, Arnold. It's kind of rough. I'm sorry. The song just totally cracks me up. I apologize. But you are definitely gonna have this song stuck in your head. Okay, that's enough with Raffy. Oh, you know, so people want more audio podcasts. I don't know why, because I just love going in there and just annoying you guys with songs like Banana Phone. But hey, look, it's food related, okay? Oh, hey, look, I got a new forum comment. Let's see what that's about. Oh, by SoundCloud listens. Ugh. These people are freaking awful. They kill me. They're killing me. You know, I just, sometimes I wake up with so much spam on the website. And no matter what you do, you can't stop it. I did find one effective way to stop it before, and that was I literally did an IP ban for the entire country of Russia, because that's where all my spam was coming from for whatever reason. And then what was even crazier than that, so it worked, I banned the entire country of Russia. I'm like, yes, nobody in Russia gives a shit about my site, and I'm just getting nothing but spam constantly. And then I got like 10 angry emails from Russians who, like, you know, when Russians are angry, it's kind of intimidating, to be completely honest with you. Saying, hey, I love your site and my IP is banned. What the hell's going on? I should kill you. No, they didn't say that. So I, you know, I'm a big softy at heart. And I didn't know what to do when I had people who were like, you know, literally begging me to let them back into the site. So I lifted the ban and I tried to do spam filters and all that sort of stuff, and they work. I mean, if you it's funny, like, if so if you're a member of the Stella Culinary community and you're checking us out on the forum a lot, I mean, you do see spam, and sometimes it gets like, it's, you know, they'll figure out a way to really get through it and it gets bad and they have to readjust the filters. But what you don't see is all the spam that my filters do catch. I mean, I get probably about 800 to 1,000 spam attempts a day in the Stella Culinary forums, which is just, it's, you know, so if I didn't have those filters in place, it'd be even more brutal than it is now. So anyways, so what we're going to try and do here is, you know, you guys like the audios. I'm going to go through and I'm going to answer some questions that we have on the forums. Nothing new. You know, if we get off topic, we get off topic. So, but there are a lot of questions that I get where, you know, they're good questions, but they may not dictate having a full audio response. So I think it'd be kind of cool to just group those smaller forum topics into audio questions. And then we still got to figure out the problem of, you know, how and where we're going to post these audios. That, you know, I can post them anywhere, really. It's just a convenience factor for you guys. So, and we talked about that in our sauces threads. If you check out our sauces thread on the forum, you can hear me kind of talk about that and, you know, give me feedback any way you want. Also, too, I have my Skype opened. Stella Culinary is my username on Skype. Stella Culinary, all one word. And you can find me, Jacob, at Stella Culinary on Skype. If you just search my email, that's another way you can find me. And I'm hoping that somebody will give me a call. I posted on the forum, but people are shy. But I think it'd be really cool to get people to call in while I'm doing these audio recordings. Even though you're not really hearing me broadcast it live, but I don't care. I'll stop what I'm saying and pick up the phone, and answer your question. You know, we can play Stump the Chef. So here we have Halloween dinner, created by Mac the Knife. And so he's talking about throwing a Halloween party. And he says, I'm starting to think about practicing ideas for a Halloween-themed dinner. Here, let me get the time code real quick. Okay, for a Halloween-themed dinner, and I'm basing my meal around the marvelous apple cider sauce I once made in the and discussed in the sauces forum. I would like some kind of pork stew. I want a stew as I can cook it and serve it tableside in a cauldron-shaped vessel. I want some exact flavors in the stew, apple maybe, but I don't want anything that will detract from the sauce. My last major meal, Burns Night, was beef and venison pie, sweet potato, braised red cabbage infused with cranberry, and honey and sherry roasted parsnips. It was yummy. This meal needs to be different, but equally yummy. Any input would be sincerely appreciated. All right, so for Halloween-themed dinner, I like the cauldron idea, and a stew is a really good way to feed somebody, or not to feed somebody. Let's see what happens when I do unedited audio like this. You hear how just what a bumble mouth I am sometimes. A stew is a great way to feed a lot of people very easily, and you serve it in a cauldron, and that's a cool kind of touch, you know. So it, the problem with Halloween themed dinners is not really like a problem with it. I mean, you can really just go fallish, you know. So like the apples and pork, that's a classic pairing, you know. So you can do all sorts of stuff with that, but if you really want to go Halloween themed, your food can get a little ghoulish, and you start, you know, doing stuff with blood, making it look weird, you know, and might turn people off. And obviously, you want them to eat and enjoy your food. So, doing a little loose theme, I mean, you just pick fall applications. Serving stew in a cauldron is awesome. Doing apples with pork is a great idea. So, one suggestion that I might make is if I was going to do, you know, you can do a basic, you know, braised pork shoulder in some stock, and you can add some vegetables or whatever. The issue with serving actual apples in the stew, obviously, is it's going to get really soft. So what you could do is you could use a little bit of apple juice for your braising liquid, which would give it an apple-y flavor. Maple and apple go good together, so you can even make your stew a little bit sweet by adding a touch of maple syrup, and that'll go nicely with the pork. And then you can balance off that the maple-y sweetness by adding some acid. So now you have like this sweet acid savory thing going on. But also too, what you could do is you can then garnish with apples that are fresh or raw. And I would do like a almost like an apple slaw with Granny Smith apples, because the Granny Smith or baking apples, they're really tart, which will be nice, especially so envision this. You take your pork. You slow braise your pork shoulder, and I'd go bone in. So slow braise your pork shoulder bone in using apple juice and a little touch of a maple syrup. Okay, and that's going to give you some fall flavors. You can even throw in like a little bit of cinnamon into it. Don't go crazy, but a little bit of cinnamon, maybe a little bit of clove. And it's going to give you this nice little underlying notes of fall spices that go good with the apple, that go good with the pork. Okay. After the slow braising process, you want to, and you can do this a couple of days ahead, you want to chill that pork shoulder in the braising liquid and then remove the bone and dice the pork. And this is, you know, I would go, I don't know, maybe half inch to 1 inch cubes, however big chunks you want your pork to be in the stew. Dice it up, reserve it, and then you can do whatever flavorings you want in that remaining braising liquid that's now going to be your soup's actual broth, right? So you have this apple-y, porky goodness braising liquid, and you can throw whatever vegetables you want, and you can season it however you want. And then right before serving, you would throw back in your pork shoulder. That's already been braised. It's already been cubed. And what you could do is, so for me, I would actually keep it simple. I would take the reserved liquid, and I would gently simmer maybe some large diced yellow onion, some shallots, maybe a very small amount of garlic, and also a touch of ginger, because ginger and pork and ginger and apples, especially with the fall spices, all go really nicely together. So do a slow simmer on that just to get the aromatics going. And you want to cook it long enough to where your onions are soft and your ginger is soft and edible, and your garlic is no longer harsh. And so you, by removing the pork shoulder from this braising liquid, you're going to have more control over your aromatics. So then you basically cook your aromatics until they're done, and then you add your pork shoulder back in right before serving. So you bring it up to simmer, heat the pork shoulder through, and then you have your soup ready to go. Now for a garnish off into the side, I would do like an apple slaw. So you take the Granny Smith apples, slice them thinly, vertically around the core, and then go back and using your good knife skills, julienne those apples as thin as possible. And then you could dress that in something like, so if you go like a little bit of sour cream and horseradish, and you use that to dress your apples, you kind of make this like loose slaw dressing, then you could use that to top your soup as a garnish, which would be awesome. And you could even like throw a little bit of a spice mix into the apple slaw if you want it, or better yet, even you would serve the soup with apple slaw like dead center in the soup, and then do a little spice mixture dusting right on top. So I like your idea of the apple, the pork stew served with apples in the cauldron, and that might be a good way to go. All right, and then he has a follow up. Mac the Knife, this weekend I'm going to attempt slow cooked pulled pork with caramelized apples. They should both be simple enough to make. Yeah, caramelized apples is nice, and you're doing like a cider reduction. So let's see how it turned out. I did the pulled pork. It didn't pull apart as I had liked, which suggests it wasn't in the slow cooker long enough. I first pulled it in the convention, put it in the conventional oven for 30 minutes. This was supposed to brown the top, which was basted and seasoned, and then put it in the slow cooker and cook for 5 hours. I then let it rest covered in foil for 30 minutes as per instructions. By this time, it had lost all its heat. Okay, so and that's just part of his question, but quick water break. For a pork shoulder, you usually want to go 190 degrees internal temperature, because that's going to fully break down the collagen and make the pork shoulder shreddable enough to where you could pull it apart and tender to eat. Now, I always recommend going with the bone-in pork shoulder, so you have that shoulder blade in, because first of all, the bone is going to give some collagen and gelatin and a little bit more flavor, body, and mouthfeel to your braising liquid, which is later going to become your broth. But also, too, the pork shoulder is going to almost be like, or excuse me, the bone is almost going to be like a built-in thermometer. So when you can pull that bone cleanly from the center of your pork shoulder, it's done. You've cooked it long enough. So always buy a bone-in pork shoulder when you can, because it's going to give you a better flavor. And if you're not using a probe thermometer, it has a built-in thermometer just by when that bone releases, it's ready to go. And then let's see, Mac the Knife, how did you, so you're talking about how you did, okay, the caramelized apples went okay. All the experts say use a hot pan. I did that and my butter burnt as soon as it touched the pan. I had to change the pan. This time I left the pan on low heat. So yeah, your butter's going to burn because it's not meant for high temp cooking applications. So for this, I would probably, you would start with oil in your pan. So your pan is still smoking hot. Add some cooking oil, which has a higher smoke point than butter. Throw in your apples, and that's going to give the apples a good sear and start the caramelization process. And then you can throw your pat of butter in once the apples have already started to brown. And then as the butter melts and starts to brown, it's going to help the apples caramelize without, but if you just drop the pat of butter directly into a really hot pan, it's going to scorch and burn on you. So then once you add your butter, you continue to cook your apples, and I would add a couple pinches of sugar, pinch of salt, and that sugar is going to help to brown the apples. Obviously, the salt's going to help to season them, and then finish with a little bit of acid right at the end, so that way you have the sort of a sweet acid savory thing going on with your caramelized apple. So add your oil to your hot pan up front, then add your butter. Okay, so I added a big pat of butter and 2 handfuls of brown sugar. Oh, okay, so there you go. I should have read more. You're on the right track. Just I added a Braeburn apple and 1 red onion. Everything mixed together well, and the result was everything I hoped it to be. I finished the dish with a couple of squirts of lemon juice. There's your acid. Okay. Well, sorry, boss. I should have. I mean, you're doing exactly how I would have done it. I've no idea whether this made any difference. what, the squirt of lemon juice? Yeah, I'm sure it did. Acid is always good. Here is my question. I used one apple and one slice of red onion. Those fitted nicely into my largest frying pan, allowing room to manipulate them. This fed two people. How do I feed six people without using a bigger pan? Surely I wouldn't be able to use the pan more than once. If I clean the pan in between, there'd be no way to maintain consistency. Also, how would you keep everything warm until service time? Please help. Okay, so it's a good question. That's an execution thing. So what you're going to do is you're just going to have to do it in batches. So do a batch of your caramelized apples and then place them into anything that's an oven-safe container. Half hotel pan is what I use. So Google search hotel pan. Get a half hotel pan for your home. They're good for holding stuff hot. They're good for braising things. That's what I braise my beef short ribs in our video. So because you're limited by pan space, you're going to have to do it ahead of time, which isn't a big deal. So you're going to have to make your caramelized apples ahead of time, and you're going to have to do a few different batches. Then you just, after you complete each batch, just put the caramelized apples into your half hotel pan and then let them chill at room temperature. They're going to be fine at room temperature for hours, no problem. I mean, it's just apples and sugar. They're not going to go bad or make people sick. Then you want to cover this hotel pan with foil. And this is assuming that you want to serve it warm. If you can serve the caramelized apples cold, too, as more like a chutney, right? So you can chill them in your fridge. And if you're going to do that, you can do this, up to a couple of days in advance. And so you have your chilled caramelized apple chutney in your fridge, which will work just fine. But assuming that you want to serve it hot, just place the half hotel pan back in your oven for about, at about 350, 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Just as, it'll probably take, say, 15, 20 minutes to heat it through completely. So while you're getting your soup ready to go and you're serving your caramelized apples alongside of it, or, it sounds like at this point you're basically just doing like a pulled pork shoulder, which is fine too. You just pop your apples in the hotel pan with the tin foil cover over the top and just heating them back through. And you're going to be fine. So that's how I would approach it. When you have limited pan space like that, there's no choice. You're going to have to cook it in batches ahead of time. And then Mac the Knife, your final question was, why do pumpkin and pecan go together? I don't know, man. Why do peanut butter and jelly go together? They just do. I would like to do something different. I was thinking biscuit, nut base, pecan or pistachio, perhaps a pumpkin layer and a mint cheesecake layer. I would then drizzle something orange across the top for a bit of a decoration. Will those flavors work together? Yeah. So let's see. It sounds like you're doing a dessert here. You'd like to do something different. So biscuit or nut base layer. So it's basically making like a cheesecake and you're looking for a crust, it sounds like. So I'll tell you what, Mac the Knife, why don't you go ahead and give me a little more info on what you're trying to do, because I'm not clear on what you're envisioning for your dessert. I'm seeing something along the lines of, it sounds like you're trying to do some sort of like pie or cheesecake, and you're trying to figure out the crust and what your filling is going to be. For me, I like to, you can do like a pumpkin cheesecake works really good. You can do like a pumpkin custard with like a ginger snap crust for, an alternative to a pie. Works awesome. And I can walk you through all of that. So feel free to just pop back into your Halloween thread and just expand on this comment a little bit more. All right. So our next thread up is going to be infused oil. And this thread's by Noya. And Noya says, hello all. Anybody who listened to the audio on the sauces thread may have heard Jacob make reference to infused oils and how they are incorporated into a sauce. Interestingly enough, Jacob pointed out that the oil used in the Indian sauce video was an infused oil as opposed to a seasoned oil. As many have learned on Stella, seasoned oil improves the flavor of deep-fried items. However, such seasoned oil is not used with sauces. So this thread relates more to finishing oil education as opposed to our original oil discussion. Anyways, I've bought a chili oil in the store amongst others. Just wondering, does anybody incorporate infused oils into their sauces? And just to clarify a little bit of terminology here. So a seasoned oil, when we're talking about a seasoned oil, that's an oil that has been cooked in multiple times. And the oil has slightly broken down to a point where it's actually, the breakdown is actually beneficial. And this seasoned oil will, it forms an emulsification really with some water content in it. And this allows the food to brown more evenly. Now, we have an extensive, multiple threads and audio responses on oil. So go ahead and search oil on the stellaculinary.com, and it'll, tons of stuff will pop up. But a seasoned oil is an oil that's used for cooking, and it's had things cooked in it before. An infused oil or a finishing oil is an oil that is infused with flavor, or an oil that just has flavor that you want to keep in its flavored state. So what I mean by that is, generally speaking, when we choose a cooking oil, we're choosing an oil that is neutral in flavor and high smoke point. And the reason being is we need our oil for cooking, and we don't want every dish to taste like that oil, right? So you want to have choice in the oil that you're cooking, or you want to have choice over your flavor structure, I should say. So if you have a cooking oil that, even if it has a high smoke point, it has a distinct flavor, then everything you cook with that oil is going to have that same flavor. So it starts to make your food taste homogenous, and it gets boring really, really quick. So when you have a cooking oil, it's usually a refined oil that has a high smoke point, like safflower oil or canola oil or extra light virgin olive oil or extra light olive oil, I should say. And those all have high smoke points and a very, very subtle flavor, if any flavor at all. Now, your infused oils are oils that are normally, you start with a cooking oil that's neutral in flavor, like canola, and then you infuse it with more flavors. So you could infuse it with onions, you can infuse it with garlic. I do a video where I show you how to make basil herb oil using basil. And so those are all infusion techniques that you're using. So you're taking a neutrally flavored oil and you are infusing flavor into it. And then these oils can be used as garnishes. So they make really good soup garnishes. You just do a little squeeze over your soup, especially if you have like a white or a light colored soup. You can squeeze an oil over the top. They make decent plate garnishes, albeit sometimes they will run on the plate. So you got to be careful how you actually apply them to the plate. But it'll add color and flavor to your plate. Or you can use those infused oils as a finishing oil where you're just drizzling them over something to enhance the flavor. Now, within that same vein are actual finishing oils that you purchase. So walnut oil, hazelnut oil, truffle oil, which is, kind of, if it's easy to really get a bad one, and it's usually kind of funky. But truffle oil is a finishing oil. We use mustard oil a lot, which I love. Argan oil is awesome until all the, all the beauty product people, I guess, like they decided that they were going to use argan oil in all like their shampoo and hair conditioners. And so it went from being a fairly expensive oil that was hard to find to being an insanely, insanely expensive oil that is impossible to track down, because all these damn women are putting argan oil in their hair to make it all shiny and pretty and stuff. And although I love a woman with a beautiful head of hair, I love my argan oil more. So I'm hoping that people will move on from this trend and I'll get my argan oil back, because it's a really awesome finishing oil. The flavor is hard to explain, but it's intense and it's awesome. So those are finishing oils. So you cook something in your canola oil or your high smoke point cooking oil. So you cook something in your cooking oil, you put it on the plate, and then you finish with your finishing oil, because that finishing oil is going to enhance the flavors on the plate. It's going to bring something else to the plate. Now, you wouldn't want to use a finishing oil as a cooking oil, because just like anything that has a good flavor, like a fine wine or something along those lines, that high temperature is going to break down the flavors in that oil. And so the oil is not going to taste as good, and you're going to have possible scorched flavors. And we talk about this extensively in our oils thread. So that's the difference on the terminology. As far as, you know, using them beyond finishing oils, you can definitely, you know, making emulsions is a great way to go. So you can take a basil-infused mayo, or excuse me, a basil-infused oil, and make a basil mayonnaise with it. So I would still grind some basil in a blender with your egg yolks and a little bit of a little touch of water. And I would blanch the basil first to set its color. But then when you're making that emulsification, you're basically just making a mayonnaise, but you happen to have some basil in the blender as well. Instead of using a neutral oil like canola oil, you can use an infused basil oil. So that's... That is an option. Let's see what Rob Sue has to say. So Rob says, we use, or so he's quoting the Indian video that we watched. So if you check out our sauces thread, I believe, there was an Indian video there. We were talking about using curries and stuff. So Rob Sue says, quoting the video, the guy in the video says, he uses sunflower oil to cook onion bhajis. I don't know what an onion bhaji is, but I assume he means cooking at normal frying temperatures, 340 degrees Fahrenheit. Therefore, his infused oil is not a finishing oil. So this has thrown me off track, because I assume that finishing oils were the same thing as infused oils, that they were both flavored oils. Yeah, so it's the same thing. An infused oil is a finishing oil. However, you can use uninfused oil for cooking, depending upon what you've infused it with. So really, like a true finishing oil is something like a walnut oil, right? Where they actually take walnuts or a toasted pecan oil, and they're pressing oil from these nuts, right? So you get this really strong flavor. So it's not uninfused oil; they're actually pressing oil from the nuts, versus like an infused oil. I gave in our sauces thread the example of, you know, infusing an oil with garlic and ginger and green onions, and you use that for a Chinese style stir fry. So that's the difference. An infused oil can be a finishing oil, but it can also be a cooking oil depending upon your application. So don't get too confused by the terminology. It's just you make the differentiation, because you don't want to be using we get this roasted pecan oil, and it's I think it's like an 8 ounce jar, or not, it's an 8 ounce bottle, and it costs us $45, and it's an awesome oil, and we use that strictly as a finishing oil. It would be totally stupid to use that as a cooking oil. It wouldn't make sense. It's expensive to use as a finishing oil, $45 for 8 ounces, and it's awesome. It's worth it. But obviously, you don't want to be sauteing vegetables in that. You want to be finishing your vegetables after they've been sauteed in canola oil or clarified butter with just a little bit of drizzle of that toasted pecan oil to bring the toasted pecan flavor. So that's really the difference. Jacob said that they cook green onions really slow in relation to stir-fry oils. What temperature and time would you put on that, Jacob? I go really low, so I do it in my wok, and I cook it just long enough to where the green onions are visibly simmering gently in the oil. And I don't know, I would say maybe 15, 20 minutes. It's hard to say. I basically just cook it till the onions are like a medium golden brown. And the you want to go by your sense of smell. You want to make sure that the green onions smell fresh and fragrant. And then when they start transitioning into that cooked onion smell, you want to pull it, because you don't want your onion to be infused. At least for me, when I'm making a green onion oil that I'm using for stir frying, I want it to taste more like green onions, not like roasted onions. And if you want to taste like roasted onions, you just take it further. So I would say, you know, low temperature, so low heat, and simmer for about 15 to 20 minutes, but really go by your nose, and your nose is going to tell you how it's going to taste. So if you want a brighter flavored, you know, green onion oil, then I would go with that. If you want a darker roasted onion flavor, I would go darker. But also, too, my argument would be if you want a roasted onion flavor, I would just use something like a yellow onion or a white onion. I wouldn't be wasting my green onions just to get a roasted onion flavor when, quite frankly, a yellow onion is cheaper and I can achieve the same goal. Onion bajas, so this is Labrador's. Onion bajas are a kind of Indian equivalent of onion rings in a ball form. They are delicious. Here's a recipe that I've used, and Labs is a long time, not only Stella culinary community member, but he goes all the way back to Free Culinary School days, freeculinaryschool.com. Yeah, he goes all the way back to those days, and has been a contributor ever since to our forums. So if he says a recipe is good, it's going to be good. This guy knows what he's talking about. And, you know, so if you see Labrador's posting on the forums, he's a good guy. He's been around probably one of the longest on here. We got some other peeps too, like Green Bake. Green Bake has not only been on the forums for a long time, but he's also a graduate of my culinary boot camp. So there's some definite OGs, and Labrador is one of them. Original gastronome, that is. Okay, so that is Noya's infused oil thread. Now, let me just hit the refresh, make sure I got all those questions. Okay, yeah. So, so now we're going to move on to getting more active. That's the title of the thread, getting more active. And it's posted by Pagan Bear. And Pagan Bear says, so I listened to episode 23 again and realized I completely forgot about the email list. So 23 is where I announce our new Stella Culinary transition. So we're still doing some pop-up dinners and private events and things of that nature, but I'm also trying to focus more time on StellaCulinary.com and really emerging it as a education company, as a culinary education company. So that's sort of the idea behind it. And I talk more in depth in the Stella Culinary School podcast, episode 23, about that, which is what Pagan Bear is referring to. He says, so now I'm signed up for that and got the F is for Flavor PDF. Oh my God, that is awesome. Well, thanks, Pagan Bear. I'm glad you like it. Is the rest of the series available for download or purchase, or is there plans for that in the future? Yeah, so there are plans for that in the future. I'm not really sure exactly how those plans are going to come to fruition. I have the curriculum pretty much, I mean, it's written and edited many times over. There's still a few more things I want to add to it, just because that's how I am. I also have lecture videos from a past boot camp shot, and all the boot camps are based on the F-Step curriculum. And I've been working on a F-Step section of the site that is meant to be sort of a digital version of the boot camp with a lot of extra videos and audio lectures and things of that nature. But I'm not sure how it's all going to come together yet. But the F-Step curriculum will be made available in one form or the other in the future. So if you want to kind of, and really, I mean, that's going to be a big part of Stella Culinary moving forward, because the F-Step curriculum really encapsulates my philosophy on cooking and the culinary art. So I'm glad you enjoyed F is for Flavor. There will be a lot more stuff to come. It's just not ready for prime time yet. Also, as an idea for something that I feel would be helpful to me, possibly others as well, is that I would like to practice some of my mother sauces. Unfortunately, I don't see a point in just making a sauce to not use for anything. Can anyone make recommendations for dishes that I might be able to make for dinner that would incorporate practicing the mother sauces? I feel fairly good about bechamel and mornay. Anyone else recognize that the high-end Kraft mac and cheese is basically doing that? But the rest, I really have nothing for. Thanks again, and happy cooking. So Wartface chimes in with a suggestion, and he says, have eggs Benedict for breakfast and practice making hollandaise, which is a really good suggestion, actually, because not only do you get to practice making hollandaise, but you also get to practice poaching eggs, which is nice. And if you want to get really crazy, you can try your hand at making some homemade English muffins as well. So eggs Benedict is good because you can practice poaching eggs and then serve your hollandaise on top. Also, hollandaise goes great with vegetables, classically speaking, asparagus. And béarnaise, which is a hollandaise offshoot, which contains tarragon and chervil, is commonly served with steaks. So you can do a little bit of béarnaise and serve that with a steak. And hollandaise is really universal. You can serve that with almost anything, really. It goes good with seafood. It can get a little bit heavy, but that's part of practicing. So you want to just make sure that you're incorporating acid, and you're kind of trying to really balance the richness that hollandaise brings to the table. Bechamel, you can make the mornay for the bechamel. I also do a bechamel-based white pizza sauce that I'm going to be releasing pretty soon in our pizza section of the website that I've been working on for a while now. But basically, I'm taking a bechamel-style sauce and blending in a bunch of blanched garlic. And I have videos on both of those. So if you watch my bechamel video, and really for this pizza sauce, I like to use Escoffier's bechamel, which is a little bit of a different approach. It incorporates some chunks of veal. So if you want to go that direction, make Escoffier's bechamel and then make just blanch a ton of garlic and take that blanched garlic, work it into your bechamel and then blend it all together and pass it through a strainer, so like a chinois, so it's nice and smooth. And then use that white garlic pizza sauce to top a Sicilian style pizza. And it's really, really, really good. And like I said, I shot a video on this. And you can use this as a universal white sauce. So for pasta, really any sort of pizza that you're making, this would work nicely for. Let's see, sauce tomate is really kind of a useless mother sauce, to be honest with you. But it's good for braising. So if you want to make a sauce tomate, you can braise a pork shoulder in it, or you can braise some beef in it, and you're basically going to have a rich French-style tomato sauce with braised items. What's good with that, so if you braise like a pork shoulder and sauce tomate, you then take that pork shoulder and you shred it up really fine, and then you mix it back into your sauce tomate. And that makes a really, so if you're in the mood for like a heavy pasta sauce, so you do like a dried spaghetti pasta, you can use that sauce, even though it's really kind of sacrilege if you ask an Italian, but you can use that pork, that shredded pork sauce tomate to top a pasta. You can just serve it almost as a stew by itself, so this tomato-y porky stew that you can serve with a good hunk of bread. Espanol is a classic. It's the forebearer of the professional reduction sauce, and then velouté is basically a white version of espagnol. So what I would really recommend, because it's good to understand the mother sauces and understand them within context and what they were used for classically, but if you haven't yet, I would watch my video. Go to stellacolonia.com/sauces and watch my video on the three modern mother sauces and kind of how we drill down sauces based upon technique. And you can also watch my video on the five French mother sauces. So I have the podcast series on the five French mother sauces, but then I also have a video that kind of brings them all together. And so all of that stuff is linked to each other if you go to stellacolonia.com/sauces. And then I talk about my approach of the three modern mother sauces, which is more of a technical approach than the five French mother sauces, which tend to be a lot more redundant and recipe-based. So it's not really a good way to learn sauce, in my opinion. Now, again, you do need to understand the five French mother sauces and understand how they've been used in historical context. but approaching your sauce making technique from the five French mother sauces, especially if you want to take your sauces to the next level, I think is a really bad roundabout way to do it. So check out my video on the three modern mother sauces, and that's actually what I teach in my F-step curriculum. So you had F is for flavor, right? Now the next step in the F-step curriculum, so F is for flavor, S is for sauce. And so a lot of information that we cover in my three modern mother sauce video is at the core of the sauce making curriculum that I publish in the F-step curriculum. All right. So if you have any more questions, please let me know. And Pagan Bear, thank you for your answer. So let's see how we're doing on time here. 41 minutes after the hour. Let's move on. We had an old thread get rustled up talking about various forms to cook eggs and scrambled eggs. So let's see here. Brian Campbell says, I tried the sour cream trick. I added 2 tablespoons to 4 scrambled eggs, probably too much because I could definitely taste the tang. Is there a typical per egg amount to add? So the sour cream trick is to help keep the eggs moist after you have cooked them. And this is specifically applicable when you're cooking large amounts of scrambled eggs and then trying to hold them hot for an extended period of time. So if you're working in a commercial kitchen and you're doing like a breakfast buffet and you have scrambled eggs on your breakfast buffet, they're not going to last if you don't add sour cream. And the trick is you add just enough sour cream to give them a creamy texture. And that sour cream is going to help to keep the scrambled eggs from overcoagulating on your steam table. But also, too, because it does add a certain level of creaminess to the eggs themselves, you can add sour cream as a finishing step to your scrambled eggs just because it's delicious. So it sounds like Brian added a little bit too much. As far as a ratio, I mean, it's hard to say because normally when I add sour cream to my scrambled eggs, it's when I'm doing large banquets and it's just, you know, I'll scramble up enough eggs to feed like 50 people and then thwack, 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 throw in a couple big spoonfuls of sour cream, stir it in, give it a taste, and put it on the steam table. So that's my approach. When making scrambled eggs at home, I go very, very light and gentle, and I don't use sour cream. I don't use milk. I don't do anything in my scrambled egg mix. The one thing that you want to stay away from, so there's two things that you want to do before you actually scramble the eggs, is number one, beat the eggs together really, really good in a bowl. So you want to beat them until they start to form ropes so that the eggs are actually cohesive. So beat them with a fork until it's a cohesive egg mixture. Next, do not add salt to your eggs because it will draw moisture out of the proteins in the eggs and it will toughen those proteins. Basically, the salt will coagulate the proteins partially and it'll make the eggs tougher, which is not what you want for a really good scrambled egg. And then you want to go low heat and a nonstick pan. Now, you can use a cast iron pan that's well seasoned, but this is one of the few times that I actually bust out my nonstick pans when I'm actually cooking eggs. So I'll go medium-low heat, and as soon as I turn, so I'll turn my burner on a medium-low heat, place my pan on top, and as soon as I place my pan on top of that burner, I drop in a pat of butter. And that pat of butter is working as a temperature guide for my pan. So once that pat of butter melts and it evenly coats the bottom of my pan, I'm going to wait for that pat of butter to start to bubble, just gently. So once I start to see that butter start to bubble, but it's not turning brown, I'm going to add my eggs. And then I'm going to just very gently, using a plastic or a one of those stirry spatulas. They have it's not Teflon, but the name, some of them are made of Teflon, but just basically a plastic spatula that you use for nonstick pans. The names are escaping me right now. And you're going to draw the scrambled eggs. You're going to draw the eggs to the center of the pan and then tilt the pan. So where you draw the eggs in, the scramble goes back and fills in that place where you remove the eggs from. So you're going to keep on drawing the eggs to the center of the pan and then sort of swirling your pan around so that loose egg mixture now hits the empty spots of the pans and starts to scramble. And you're going to continue this over medium-low heat, or even low heat if you have the patience for it, until your eggs are just barely coagulated. So you don't want them runny. I mean, some people like them runny, but I think the perfect scrambled egg is loose and creamy. It's fully set, meaning that there's not any, so when you put it on the plate, there's not any liquid from the eggs escaping, but it's just barely fully set. And then I'll transfer this to a plate and then sprinkle with a little bit of salt and then freshly cracked black pepper, if you like pepper on your eggs. But you want to wait till the end to actually season your eggs. And this method is exactly the same for making an American-style omelet. So the mistake that a lot of people make when they make an American-style omelet is they try and put the they'll put the eggs in the scrambled eggs in the pan, right? And they'll let that egg set, and then they'll try and put the filling in, but that's not what you want, because at that point, you're going to be overstuffing your omelet. It's just not going to work out. So the way that you do it, like the restaurant method, is you want to saute your ingredients in your nonstick pan until they're to whatever desired temperature you want. And again, you're going to do this over medium heat. You don't want to overheat your nonstick pan. So if I'm making like a mushroom, onion, let's say I'm making a mushroom, onion, and spinach omelet with Monterey Jack cheese. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put three eggs into my bowl. I'm going to give them a good forking and scramble them up, okay? And then my pan, medium heat, throw in a little pat of butter, add in my onions and my mushrooms, and saute them until they're fragrant, right, and soft. Now I'm going to actually hit my pan with a little bit of water, and this is going to do two things. It's going to cool the pan off so it doesn't burn my eggs, and the water is going to release steam, which is going to help to finish softening my onions and my mushrooms. And I'm going to continue to simmer that water until it's completely gone. All right, so now I have a dry pan again. Now, before my pan gets too hot, because now it's dry, so it can rise past the boiling point of liquid, which is 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius at sea level, I'm going to add in a pat of cold butter, and I'm going to add my eggs directly on top. Now I'm going to use my scrambling method, where I just pull the eggs into the center and then move that egg mixture around and then pull it into the center, move it around. And then once the eggs look almost fully coagulated, I'm going to press down the eggs in the center of the pan using my spatula. So now I have like this, a flat egg disc that has the onions and the mushrooms embedded into it. Oh yeah, we said we're going to use spinach too. So I would add the spinach during the water stage, where you add a little bit of water, you throw in a handful of spinach, the spinach is going to wilt with the steam. All right, so now you have your onion, mushroom, spinach, egg mixture that you've scrambled up. Press that down into an even disc, add your cheese in, and just put your cheese right in the middle. And then what you want to do is you do a dismount where you basically have an egg pancake right now with cheese right in the center. And then you want to grab your pan underhand. So normally when you're sauteing, you're holding it overhand where your thumb is facing the pan. You're going to actually grab your pan underhand, so the handle of your pan underhand, so your thumb is facing away from your pan. And then you're going to gently tap the handle of the pan with your other hand to get the egg or the omelet edge up over the front lip that is directly opposite of the handle. So you want that to get over, just barely over the front lip of the pan. And then as you place that omelet onto the plate, you're going to do a folding motion with the pan, and you're going to fold the egg, the other half of the egg, over the top. And that's going to give you your finished omelet on the plate. And the residual heat from the omelet is going to melt the cheese as you serve it. So you're using the exact same scrambling method, and that scrambling method where you're pulling the eggs into the center and then you're rolling the unscrambled egg around to the dry parts of the pan is going to give you a fluffy scrambled egg, but it's also what's going to give you a nice fluffy omelet. All right. Brian also says, I can cook great scrambled eggs on their own, but the minute I try to add cooked sausage or mushrooms, it turns into a mess. I usually cook the mushrooms, for example, until almost dry before adding butter and eggs. but it just results in a coagulated mess that sticks to the mushrooms. Should I remove the mushrooms and add them back when the eggs are almost done? No, you're just, you know, I mean, that's kind of what a scramble is. But if you, so you want to make sure that you're using that water to cool off the pan, right? And then reduce that water out, add your little pat of butter, and then add in your eggs, and then just do that gentle scrambling. So again, you're working it over, you know, medium-low heat and gently scrambling and coagulating those eggs. And that should do the trick. That should get you where you're going. Mucho Bocho chimes in saying, Brian, I make scrambled eggs a lot for my 9 and 10-year-olds. My suggestion is to keep it simple. Crack eggs in a cold pan with a few pats of butter. He clarifies his butter. Using medium-low heat and a rubber spatula. Rubber, that's the word I was looking for. I couldn't remember the word rubber to describe a spatula. I'm such an idiot sometimes. work the eggs, tossing and mixing constantly until the eggs are not runny but not firm. Then remove from the heat, season with salt, toss around again. They become transformed into small, curd, buttery eggs. Same way that the classic French omelet is made, only you don't have to worry about plating it pretty. Happy cooking, Mucho. Yeah, so Mucho goes directly into his pan with the eggs, which is another approach. Some chefs prefer this. I prefer to scramble my eggs first, personally, if I'm making scrambled eggs or an omelet. I feel it gives me a more cohesive scramble. I also feel it allows me to keep the scrambled eggs less cooked, so they're more moist without the liquid breaking away, because you don't want, I mean, so even though you want moist scrambled eggs, when you put them on the plate, you don't want to see water breaking away from those eggs. So, but, you know, different strokes for different folks. Whatever, I mean, I have professional chef friends, excuse me, who use the exact same technique as Mucho. And that's part of the fun of cooking is, you know, there's more than one way to cook an egg, actually quite a few. And you can discuss egg cookery for an hour with another food geek. And actually, the discussion could be very, very interesting, in my opinion. Other people just, like, my wife sits there and rolls her eyes, and she's like, Christ, it's just scrambled eggs. Give it a rest already. It's just scrambled eggs. And me and my buddies were just like, no, you got to break it like that. You know, are you crazy? You can't. What's wrong with you? So, anyways. So that's scrambled eggs. Okay, we are almost at the hour mark. We are at 53 minutes, and this is a kind of a tester audio. So again, I'm just going through the tabs here and answering questions. So please give me some feedback if you like this style, if you want to hear more audios like this where I'm just kind of going through and tabbing through the different forum threads and hitting them with audio answers. Let me know, or you might just prefer the more focused, you know, audio answer to just that singular thread. But what's nice is I think, you know, people, they click on these audio answers and it gets them involved in other cooking threads. I mean, there's people asking about infused cooking oils who may never have stumbled across the audio answer that I gave to Mac the Knife. And I think we talked about some pretty cool stuff between, you know, making a braised pork soup using apple cider and you know, making an apple slaw to garnish it on top, and sort of the methods and approaches that that I would use, and maybe Mac the Knife would never have heard about the infused oils or scrambling eggs. So, anyways, let me know what you guys think. I'm doing this for you. So if you hate them, you know, there's no reason for me to do them. And we can figure out a better way to go through these forum comments that you guys will like better. So I'm going to stop it here before I get too far ahead of myself. And next time you see that I'm online with Skype, go ahead and give me a ring-a-ding on my good old banana phone. And we can go from there, right? Do some live answers. I've got my hunches. It's the best, beats the rest.
modular, interactive modular, ring, 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 banana phone. Ping pong, ping pong, ping pong, ping, banana phone. It's no baloney, it ain't a phony, my cellular, bananular phone. Don't need quarters, don't need dimes to call a friend of mine. Don't need computer or TV to have a real good time. I'll call for pizza, I'll call my cat, I'll call the White House, have a chat, my place to call.
Was that supposed to be some kind of sick joke?
Ring, 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 banana phone. Yin, yang, yin, yang, yin, yang, yin, banana phone. It's a real life mama and papa phone, a brother and sister and a dog a phone, a grandpa phone and a grandma phone too. Oh yeah, my cellular, bananular phone, banana phone. Ring, ring, ring. This song drives me bananas. Banana phone.
Be more
ring,
funny.
Ring.